Court will proceed to the sixth case, Jens versus Barnhart. Commissioner. Mr. Duncan.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Dana Duncan. I'm the attorney for the plaintiff, Mr. Jens. The case comes before the court on two primary issues that I want to address in my oral argument. Other issues that were raised in the brief can best be handled by the brief. First issue is whether there was adequate findings on the credibility of my client made by the administrative law judge. Second issue is based on this record, given the testimony of the vocational expert that testified at the Social Security Disability Hearing, that substantial evidence exists to support the ALJ's decision. With regard to the first issue, the ALJ's findings are inadequate, and this is a basis requiring the commissioner's decision to be overturned. With regard to the second issue, and that specifically is the ALJ's failure to consider Mr. Jens' difficulty of concentration, persistence, and pace, the ALJ's decision is not supported. On page 19 of the transcript, the ALJ's decision states the above discussion suggests the claimant's testimony and written statements were not entirely credible. But a review of the evidence seems to indicate that what specifically was objectionable. He notes that he reviewed his daily activities, that he's able to drive, socialize, and go fishing. He then talks about medical treatment, but concludes that the record as a whole indicates the claimant sought consistent, appropriate treatment for his various medical conditions. He then forms an additional basis, no other basis, and comes to the conclusion that my client was not credible. The commissioner, in their brief, cites several other examples in the record. No other mention is made of his subjective complaints. For instance, they make mention of his pain complaints were inconsistent with Dr. Lear's opinion, that Dr. Swenson's comments about Mr. Jens' pain being out of proportion to his laboratory finding, that he had a normal mental status during one of his examinations. The law is clear in Golan Bielski versus Barnhart. This court ruled the general principles of administrative law preclude the commissioner's lawyers from advancing grounds in support of the agency's decision that were not given by the ALJ. And then specifically, the government continually tries to bolster the ALJ's decision by citing evidence which was not noted by the administrative law judge. In this particular circumstance, if the issue had been on his credibility, and this point was raised in Golan Bielski, what effect would this have? And as one example, I would note to the court that the administrative law judge, in his questioning, providing examples to the vocational expert, indicated that if Mr. Jens was to miss one day per month from his work, that would preclude him from his past relevant work. And in this particular circumstance, Mr. Jens testified throughout the hearing that he had missed several weeks of employment as a result of his condition. And as a result of this, that type of testimony would have been sufficient if Mr. Jens had been found credible to be a basis for finding him disabled. The last point, or the second point that I'm alleging, is more of a issue of semantics. The administrative law judge in the transcript found, first of all, that agreed with the vocational expert on the transcript on page 75 that his past relevant work was sedentary and semi-skilled. The ALJ found that Mr. Jens also experienced deficiencies of concentration, persistence, and pace, transcript page 16. The residual functional capacity did not include that specific concentration, persistence, and pace in its finding. semi-skilled work requires concentration, persistence, and pace. In my reply brief, I provided the court with both the administrative regulation on that and the internal administration regulation, the POM, as well as a Social Security ruling on that issue. So therefore, if concentration, persistence, and pace found by the administrative law judge was to be considered appropriately, he would have been excluded from from semi-skilled work. The vocational expert testified on page 27 of the 77 of the transcript that his that if he was precluded from doing semi-skilled work, obviously he would not be able to perform his past relevant work. No finding on that level. No mention is made of persistence and pace, and the decision is internally inconsistent with itself. Findings by the judge are not made in the conclusion and are inconsistent with the finding of that he is anything but disabled. Barring any questions, I will reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Duncan. Ms. Kim.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. My name is Christine Kim, and I represent the Commissioner of Social Security. Initially, the government would like to point out that it is Mr. Jen's burden to prove through steps 1 through 4 of the sequential evaluation that he is disabled. And this sequential evaluation is used by the agency in determining... Yes, Your Honor?
We know that.
Okay. In this case, the ALJ determined at step 4 that Mr. Jens, despite his severe impairments, retained the residual functional capacity, or RFC, to perform his past relevant work, which was sedentary and semi-skilled. Turning first to the RFC, the ALJ gave controlling weight to the opinion of Dr. Lear, who was Mr. Jens' treating physician for at least 3 years. And turning to Mr. Opposing counsel's argument regarding the deficiencies in concentration, persistence, and pace, the ALJ found that Mr. Jens often had deficiencies in concentration, persistence, and pace, but that it was due to pain. And the ALJ accordingly gave Mr. Jens a very restricted RFC to account for Mr. Jens's pain. Often deficiencies in concentration, persistence, and pace indicates a moderate limitation in this area. And this is consistent with a limitation to semi-skilled work, which is defined as work which needs some skills but does not require doing the more complex work duties. And so semi-skilled work does reflect some limitation in complexity. And this is indicated in the hypothetical question that the ALJ posed to...
Why do they ask these people hypothetical questions? Why don't they just ask... It was only a one-day hearing. Why don't they just ask, okay, you've heard the evidence about this person. What kind of jobs do you think exist which, in his area which he is physically or mentally able to fill? Then you wouldn't have all these disputes over whether the hypothetical question was adequate.
You're asking why do ALJs ask hypothetical questions?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I believe that the ALJs ask hypothetical questions because the vocational experts to benefit from the expertise.
No, it's because they used to do it the suggested way, and courts started reversing the Social Security Administration for doing it because the court would then say, well, we don't know which testimony the ALJ believed, the vocational expert believed. And so after losing a series of these cases, the SSA changed its approach.
Well, now they can change it back since they're getting reversed on hypothetical questions.
Well, in any event, the ALJ specifically limited in the hypothetical question the person to semi-skilled work to account for decreased concentration.
What I find troublesome about the hypothetical question is it puts it in such artificial form. So instead of the vocational expert talking about a real person, he's talking about this construct, this abstraction.
Well, I really can't speak to what the comment that you're making, Your Honor. But in this case, as the hypothetical question must adequately reflect the claimant's functional limitations. And in this case, that is exactly what the ALJ did. And he accounted for Mr. Jens's decreased concentration, which was a result of his pain, by limiting him to semi-skilled work. And the evidence does support this conclusion. The evidence does not show that Mr. Jens's concentration was so limited that he could only perform unskilled work, but rather it supports the ALJ's conclusion that even with his decreased concentration as a result of pain, that he was still able to perform semi-skilled work, which was consistent with the limitations given by Dr. Lear, his treating physician. And this is supported by evidence in the record such as normal to mild findings as found by Dr. Lear on several mental status examinations, as well as the report from Dr. Rowe, who was the consulting psychologist, who on memory testing found that he had no problems and also gave him a global assessment of functioning score of 60, which is on the border of mild and moderate limitations. And again, the government would like to point out that Dr. Lear never gave an opinion that Mr. Jens had mental limitations, that Mr. Jens himself never complained of concentration difficulties to his treating physician, and Dr. Rowe didn't give such an opinion, and in fact, no examining or treating physician gave an opinion that Mr. Jens had any mental limitations. This is also supported by the testimony of the medical expert who reviewed the record, and he testified that nothing in the record indicated that Mr. Jens had mental limitations based on memory or concentration losses. And furthermore, Mr. Jens's testimony is also supportive of this conclusion. He stated at the hearing that he read for several hours every day and that he was able to concentrate when he read books and watched television. So the ALJ came to this conclusion based on a review of the record as a whole, and in evaluating the medical opinions and the medical evidence, he appropriately gave controlling weight to the opinion of Dr. Lear, and so therefore his RFC finding is supported by substantial evidence. Turning to Mr. Jens's argument regarding credibility, the ALJ found that Mr. Jens's subjective complaints of pain were not entirely credible, and this finding is supported by substantial evidence as well. In pages 18 and 19 of the transcript, the ALJ specifically discussed
which portions of the complaints were not credible. I don't understand these findings. The ALJs have this finding in the glossary of their word processor, and they have the right key and out it comes, and it's not entirely credible. But what does that mean concretely?
It means that he found that Mr. Jens's complaints were credible, consistent,
except in the way in which they weren't, and then the ALJ doesn't explain which were credible and which weren't.
Well, Mr. Jens clearly had a serious impairment,
I don't think credibility has much to do with this. We need to look at the physician's reports, but it's not very helpful to outsiders to say he has made the following claims, which are not entirely credible.
Well, although the ALJ may have done the best job, I think that in this
the ALJ in this case actually did a perfectly normal job. That phrase must appear in 99.44% of all the cases we see, because it's in the glossary of their word processors. And it is utterly, completely useless in all of the cases. I just don't understand why it keeps appearing.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor. The ALJ did acknowledge that Mr. Jens had pain, that he had some pain.
What do you think the ALJ disbelieved?
She disbelieved Mr. Jones's allegation that he had so much pain that he was completely disabled and was unable to do any job that exists in the national economy.
Well, you're mixing facts and law there.
Oh, sorry.
He basically believed that he exaggerated the pain. Isn't that what the position of the Social Security Administration is?
That
he exaggerated the extent of the pain.
Well, I can see how his finding of his complaints not being entirely credible could be seen as being an exaggeration. Yes, Your Honor.
Well, that's the way I'm interpreting that he exaggerated, because he relied on, was it Dr. Swanson's report, that it was out of proportion,
yes,
to what the lab findings are?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. He said that his complaints of pain were still out of proportion to his objective laboratory findings.
So actually, the ALJ was tailoring it, in his view, off of the evidence that presented as well as the representations made by the claimant, right?
I'm not quite sure.
Well, when he says that on the credibility issue, what he is doing is he's suggesting that there's it's out of whack with the evidence that's presented by the expert.
That it was inconsistent with the evidence as a whole, yes, Your Honor. The ALJ did discuss several factors, not only his activities of daily living, but Mr. Jones's medical treatment and his medication. And critically, he noted that this was inconsistent with Dr. Lear's opinion, that Dr. Lear did not give an opinion that Mr. Jones could not work, but he gave work restrictions, which the ALJ accordingly adopted in his RFC finding. So based on the ALJ's review of the evidence as a whole, we see that his RFC finding was supported by substantial evidence, and that Mr. Jones's past relevant work of being of a buyer planner and a production scheduler, that these jobs were sedentary and semi-skilled, and that they did not exceed Mr. Jones's RFC. Therefore, the ALJ's decision is supported by substantial evidence, and we request that you affirm the ALJ's decision.
Thank you, Ms. Kim. Mr. Duncan?
Thank you. Judge, in response to your question about exaggeration, I would have to agree with the government on that point if the ALJ had bothered to make any findings regarding Dr. Swanson's report. There's nothing in his decision that mentions it. The only place that it's mentioned is in the government's brief.
Well, he had it before. You're saying it's an inadequate explanation by the ALJ, or we're going to presume that he did not take it into account.
Correct.
He says he's not entirely credible. He is not calling him an outright liar, because he obviously recognizes his evidence of pain. But it seems to me, common sense would be, that he believes he's exaggerating the extent of the pain.
That's exactly the case. But he needs to say that, and he needs to apply the ruling 96-7, which goes through and analyzes the whole process. So the problem that Judge Easterbrook raised about why these findings are constantly in here is because the administrative law judge never writes his own decision. They have professional writers who do this. The judge fills out a form, says what he wants, and then hands it to them, and he only sees it again when he signs it.
Well, he adopts it, though.
I understand that, but the problem is...
You're really accusing us of having law clerks.
What are these people called?
They are non-lawyers, and they are called decision writers.
Decision writers and non-lawyers. And
correct. They're non-lawyers.
Are they assigned individually to an administrative law judge, or are they...
No, they're done in a pool. Your writer could be based out of the Milwaukee office, it could be based out of the Minneapolis office, it could be based out of Chicago for all...
Well, they work off the record that was produced, right?
Correct.
Is it much different than a opposing counsel submitting findings of fact after a Victoria situation, a single counsel submitting findings of fact, and a district judge accepting and tailoring them if he or she believes that's appropriate?
That is correct, but in this particular case, I'm just pointing out that's why that language seems to be in there. And the other factor is that...
Well, I'm not in there because in these cases, most of these folks have some problem, Mr. Duncan. I'm sure you're as a practitioner. So the question always is, these overworked ALJs have to make a call on some sort of grade or sliding scale whether or not the disability as represented by the claimant, you know, reaches a threshold deserving of benefit.
Correct.
So apparently credible has become, for want of better term, better phrase, some sort of term of art. You don't want to call these claimants who are obviously hurt with some degree of injury outright liars. But you say they can't read correctly their own pain, I guess that's what you're saying.
Your Honor, to some degree, it's a little even more telling than just that. The reason I am before the court is because there's nobody in northern Wisconsin appealing these decisions. And 40% of the hearing decisions at the ALJ phase are denied by records from Social Security. So what ends up happening is the judges seem to know that if they put language in that says that the person is uncredible or is lacks credibility.
Are you saying 40% of all applications are denied or 40% in northern Wisconsin?
40%
nationwide
of hearings before administrative law judges are denied.
So let me, now these administrative law judges, how many of these opinions do they issue a year, each of them?
I am a normal, regular practitioner, and next week, for example, one administrative law judge will be holding hearings in Wausau, Wisconsin. I have four with him that day. He will be conducting approximately 12 hearings that day. He will be doing 4 days' worth. So he will have approximately 48 hearings. That's a little higher than normal.
But he might issue 1,000 decisions. Is that possible?
It's very possible. Yeah. They do have judges now, in order to lighten the load, have brought in staff attorneys who do have authority to issue decisions on the record without a hearing, based upon the test or the information that the attorneys gather and file.
You have to opt into that system, Mr. Duncan, just as a staff attorney. I'm just asking you, it's a matter of information. I mean,
you have to give
your consent to not have the ALJ be the initial arbiter of these matters.
You have no consent, no control, anything. Whichever judge is drawn.
I understand whatever ALJ is drawn.
Correct.
As a staff attorney, I'm not familiar with that. Is that, could you say, no, I want someone who's been appointed an administrative law judge rather than that?
If you get a staff attorney to review the file and grant your decision, that means you won. So
no, I understand that, but I'm saying, maybe I'm not understanding it correctly. I thought it was these are alternative decision making.
No. The only decision is a favorable decision that's done by the staff attorney, and that's just to take cases that would have been successful at hearing and take them off the docket for scheduling purposes.
All right. Well, thank you for that information. Thank you to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will stand in recess.